Hey, folks.
Hello.
My name is Ellen Adair.
And I am Eric Gildy.
And welcome to Take Me Into the Ballgame.
Yeah.
In an effort to bring the entire Take Me Into the Ballgame project into one feed, we are going to be releasing our old episodes on Pitcher List week by week.
Yes. Enjoy for the first time or revisit an old favorite.
And so now, this is one of them. Hey, folks.
Hi.
And welcome to Take Me Into the Ballgame.
Take me into the ballgame.
Ooh.
Ooh. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Working on some new language stuff with the alien dialect. I'm still working on the dialect. But
it seems like there are some definite cognates in the middle of your alien dialect to take me into the ballgame. I mean, if indeed that is what you said and not something else.
Yeah, well, hey, maybe.
That man over there mastering the alien tongues is Eric Gildy.
Oh, hello.
And I am Ellen Adair. And we are two actors who, in a season with less baseball, decided that we would watch baseball movies. And
yeah.
Then we decided that we would grade them on the 20 to 80 scouting scale used for baseball prospects.
That's the plan, and we stuck with it.
It's true. We're still doing it, folks. So if you're not familiar with the 20 to 80 scouting scale, we're going to go over that in a little bit.
Your patience is greatly appreciated.
But this week, we are talking about an episode of The X-Files titled The Unnatural.
The Unnatural.
Presumably a play on The Natural.
Yes, yes. And this is season 6, episode 19, originally aired April 25th, 1999. This is a standalone episode, and, you know, surprisingly, maybe, this was not actually one of my shows. It feels like the kind of thing that, like, should have been totally my jam when it came out, but it just never really caught my attention at the right time. So I've only seen a couple of episodes. What about you?
This is the one and only episode of The X-Files that I've ever seen. If you're just joining us, I never had a television until 2010, which means that I'm behind on basically everything. However, because I spent so much of my life without a television, I got pretty good at sort of absorbing some things through cultural osmosis. So the things that I knew about The X-Files without ever having watched a single episode is that the characters' names were Mulder and Scully, and that they were looking for alien life. And that all the viewers wanted them to get together. These are the things that I knew about The X-Files.
And also the truth and it being out there.
I had absorbed that as well. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, yes, this episode is titled The Unnatural. It is, well, I guess, you know, The Natural is about sort of like a legendary come out of nowhere, you know, baseball performance by someone coming back. And this, I guess, it's not like a super direct comparison, but roughly this episode mostly takes place in flashback in 1947, where a baseball team called the Roswell Grays, this is a Negro League team, has a player who is actually an alien. The player Josh Exley is actually from beyond and is playing incognito because of his great love for baseball, even as an alien. And there's an alien bounty hunter trying to hunt him down and get him. And there is a local law enforcement official named Arthur Dales who is trying to protect him. Anything I'm missing from that?
Not really. There's a little bit of a framing device with Mulder and Scully at the beginning and the end, and we also see Mulder finding Arthur Dales as an older man. So in the flashbacks, obviously, we have Arthur Dales the younger and his conversations with the older Arthur Dales about what may have transpired with this Negro Leagues player.
Yes, yes. So this episode was written and directed by David Duchovny. David Duchovny had never written or directed for the show before this. this, although I think he had contributed to some of the story development for a few episodes. Jesse L. Martin plays Josh Exley, the aforementioned player who is also an alien. Duchovny cast him after seeing Jesse playing Tom Collins in Rent, as well as his performance on Ally McBeal.
That's kind of hilarious because I didn't know that, but when I was watching it, I was definitely like, oh, Tom Collins finally made it to Santa Fe.
We'll open up a restaurant in Santa Fe and play baseball as an alien.
That's great. Yeah, probably not quite in the same key as Jesse L. Martin sings it, but
it's true. It's true. But maybe it'd be a really good harmony with him.
Yeah, who knows?
Let's get him on the phone. So there's plenty to talk about here, but I don't know that we need to set the table much more than that. So maybe we should get into those ratings.
Yeah. So if you are just joining us, the main thing to know is that 50 is average. However, in this case, average is good.
Yeah.
So if you as a scout can find a player that you think has a 50 grade tool, that means that they're set to be an average productive major league player in that particular skill that they have, whether it's their hit tool or their power or their defense, whatever it is.
Yeah. Hey, you know, like an average alien, you're still like, whoa, an alien.
Yeah, exactly. So below that, 40, 30, and 20 are progressively less good.
Yeah, then you're getting like a microbe that is discovered or like evidence of that. You're like, yeah, I guess that's alien life. But the big headline being like, NASA has game-changing news kind of like led you to hope for something more than that.
Yeah, more than like there used to be water on this planet and so maybe there was life. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Right. Okay, I guess that's all.
Conversely,
good for you, Moon.
Indeed. 60, 70, and 80 are progressively better and better, with in the baseball world, 80 representing either like a Hall of Fame level talent or a sort of a franchise player.
Oh yeah, we're talking E.T., we're talking the xenomorph. We're talking the xenomorph in Spaceballs that dances around like Michigan J. Frog. We're talking like
those aliens from Avatar.
The Na'vi. Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking the Mos Eisley Cantina.
We are talking the Mos Eisley Cantina, where they are doing their alien stuff with great diversity and talent and joy and Han shot first.
And those in that Amy Adams movie where she's trying to figure out how to talk to the aliens, I feel like those are maybe like 60 grade aliens.
Yeah, they're pretty good. They have a lot of really good alien stuff to offer, but they don't seem to be joyfully playing musical instruments in a Wild West-esque setting.
Yeah, totally.
And you got to dock them some points on that.
Yeah. So if that didn't explain it for you, gentle listeners, I don't know what can.
Clear as a bell as far as I'm concerned.
So now we're going to move along to the various tools that we are scoring this television episode on. And the first one is amount of baseball.
Amount of baseball for me is going to be a 40 and a 5 together to make a 45.
Right.
And the reason for that is that, you know, there's baseball around. It's not bad. This is a TV show, so we have some similar kind of issues as we did with the Mighty Casey, and that it's just sort of a shorter chunk of time to tell the story. We do get baseball and baseball activities throughout, but we're not super following particular games. Mm-hmm. We see Mulder and Scully taking some BP with the strange child that is maybe also an alien that we can talk more about later. Mm. And that's all well and good and is, again, kind of baseball, but it's just not the best or the most satisfying kind of baseball on screen. It's fine, but it is below average.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm pretty solidly in the 45 camp.
Yeah, this is very tough. You know, I've previously stated that what I will count towards amount of baseball is activity with a glove and a ball, mm-hmm. and ideally a bat. And as you just said, it's only a 45-minute episode, and we've previously established that amount of baseball is a ratio stat and not a counting stat. And there are a reasonable number of baseball-related scenes here, so I'm going to go with a 40, but I don't like it because part of me feels like it doesn't deserve more than a 30. And I might just sort of have to say to Jim, that's my scouting director, Jim, first of all, don't fire me because revenues are down from the pandemic. But then I'd say, Jim, there's technically a 40 grade amount of baseball here, but I don't project it to have much growth. Yeah. And the issue is that really only the opening sequence has much, if any, interest in the craft of baseball or with baseball as part of the narrative.
Hmm. Yeah, so I guess that's true.
There's never a moment when we're really excited about whether or not someone is going to do well or get better. There's absolutely no base running in the entire episode. Although this is 2020, so maybe we're used to that. But there are no defensive plays, but nor are we interested in someone getting better at pitching, like in Million Dollar Arm or the excellent Stratton story montages.
Yeah, it's true. We are introduced to Exley as being an alien, and he is just like very good.
Well, we don't know that he's an alien initially.
Right.
But we're never meant to be excited about a baseball outcome, is I guess my point. Like, the viewers presumably are only supposed to be excited that Mulder and Scully are practically embracing so that they can hit baseballs together, which, look, it still counts towards amount of baseball. I think it counts, and I think it counts when Exley and Dales are sort of lackadaisically throwing the ball to each other as they talk. It counts.
For sure.
I just don't like it. Because here is the baseball action that we see in this episode. Number one, Exley hits a foul ball. Number two, Exley hits a home run. Next game, number one, Exley is hit by a pitch. Next game, Exley hits a home run. That's it. Four baseball outcomes in a 45-minute episode. I feel like there was actually more baseball in the Twilight Zone episode, even if we were talking about it being a counting stat and not a ratio stat.
Yeah, I think you might be right. That's wild. And like you said, it is baseball, but, you know, it's like, you know, a single carrot stick is food, but that doesn't make it a meal.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, I feel like we're back into sort of the counting ketchup as a vegetable category here a little bit.
Right.
So I'm going to move along to our next tool, which is baseball accuracy.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy.
And I think, to be honest, though I don't double count baseball accuracy, it doesn't help that our chief baseball sequence at the top of the episode has a lot of baseball accuracy issues. So I don't think I can go above a 30.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot.
I'm like more in the 40 range, but I want to hear some of this 30 justification.
Yeah, well, some of it I sort of evolved over time, but I had some strong initial problems. So this game, as we learn from our little Chiron at the very beginning of the episode, is supposed to take place on July 2nd, 1947. And we see a team playing, and they have grays emblazoned across the front of their uniform in exactly the same lettering that we see on the Homestead grays.
Yeah, you see the jerseys even before you see the, like, Roswell grays, which I think you really only see, like, on the bus.
You
right?
don't learn that until later in the episode.
And it seems like it's maybe just the Homestead grays.
Yeah, so my thought initially was, would the Homestead grays be playing a random white team in the middle of a field in the summer?
In the Southwest?
In the Southwest, first of all, yes, yeah. Where there was never a Negro League team in New Mexico. But for a team of that caliber, of the Homestead Grays, barnstorming would have been an off-season thing, right?
Like, I think so.
I am not a Negro Leagues expert. I've only read a couple of books, but I still felt like even if they're barnstorming, wouldn't it have to be attended by more than pickup trucks to make it worth their while?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems like it certainly wouldn't be smack in the middle of July.
Yeah, in the middle of nowhere. Like, my hackles were just raised because it's depicting Negro League baseball as this kind of like just a few people in a mud field, as opposed to the popular, well-attended league that it was, especially from sort of World War II until integration, which is exactly where we are right now in 1947. But I mean, the Grays played half of their games in the Senators Stadium and half in the Pirates Stadium. They were playing in major league ballparks.
Right.
So then, however, as we said, we find out later in the episode, it's not the Homestead Grays. these are the Roswell Grays, a different team.
Yeah, which is obviously like having a little fun, like aside from the fact that like Exley is definitely modeled on Josh Gibson, which...
Yes, I would like to get into that.
Which we will get into. There is also just the kind of winking wordplay of Grays being a term for a particular type of extraterrestrial being. And so there is a kind of like fun thing that David Duchovny, I think, was doing there of like the Grays, you know, like the aliens, like Roswell, blah, 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 blah. But it still is an homage that is a bit confusing in terms of accuracy.
In terms of accuracy, it's just a little bit of tearing at the fabric of reality type issue here, the kind that we saw in The Fan. So, you know, if you're going to use the exact uniforms that the Homestead Grays did, but just make them a different team, that's fine. I'm just going to dock you baseball accuracy points.
Sure.
And to me, actually, the larger issue is that, as you said, Josh Exley is very clearly meant to be like Josh Gibson. So this is not in and of itself a problem. Like, on the one hand, please, please make all of your characters like Josh Gibson, please. Because as I have contended, the dreamiest baseball movie catcher of all time is Leon Carter of the Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings.
This is true.
And he is extremely Gibson-esque. But his name isn't Josh, and they're not talking about him hitting 60-plus home runs, and they're not referring to him as the Black Babe Ruth. Like, these are all very clear Josh Gibson signifiers, as clearly as Bobby Rayburn was Barry Bonds in The Fan.
Right.
Okay, so fine. This is a sad, cold, alternate reality in which we don't have Josh Gibson, and I'm just going to have to take Raleigh Mackey or Buck Leonard as my Negro Leagues baseball boyfriend. But then, in the final scene, Mulder is wearing a Gibson jersey. No, we can't have two the Black Babe Ruths. It's exactly the same problem that we had in The Fan.
Yeah, and even more than that, so we get to this story of 1947 after Mulder and Scully are spending a beautiful Saturday inside. Mulder's looking at some obituaries from the Roswell area in the 40s, looking for abnormalities, things that can like sort of put him on the scent of a case. And he sees a photo from a paper at that time that shows a young version of Arthur Dales, who he knows from, you know, all of these X-Files and the doing of them. And there's also an alien bounty hunter. So he goes and looks for Arthur Dales. He finds Arthur Dales' brother, also named Arthur. We'll get into that in a little bit. And before he like gains the trust of the brother, he like gives a little quiz and they have like some back and forth about players. Part of this is the contention of Arthur Dales that basically all of the legendary players, all of the like 70, 80 grade players basically are aliens. And so it's like Mickey Mantle, yep, Willie Mays, yep, DiMaggio, so on and so forth. And then he says Gibson. And in my mind at that moment, I thought clearly he was referring to Josh Gibson, but instead Arthur Dales says Bob or Kirk. So there are like so many Gibsons being discussed.
Yes.
And yet this is a world without Josh Gibson, but apparently there is, because then there's
there
the jersey
is Josh Gibson
afterwards. So it was just very confusing.
Yes, if he's got the jersey, why wouldn't he mention Josh in that moment? Like, it sort of, it didn't bother me at the time, because I was like, right, Josh Exley is Josh Gibson, and so Josh Gibson doesn't exist, because I hadn't yet gotten to the part of the episode in which he had a Josh Gibson jersey. In terms of that scene, actually, where Arthur Dales is sort of challenging Mulder about how much he knows about baseball, I bristled a little bit, just because I hate that the signifier for do you or do you not know about baseball in television and film always seems to me like, name me a very specific number.
Yeah, I agree. It's the kind of thing that made me feel as a child like, I guess I'm not a baseball fan because I can't rattle off these random numbers the way that they always seem to be able to in the TV shows.
Yeah, because Arthur Dales asks him how many home runs Mickey Mantle hit.
Yeah, and Mulder sort of thinks about it for a second and says 163, and Arthur Dales is like, this guy, get out of my face. And then Mulder is like, right-handed, 373 lefty, 536 total, which is cool and a nice nod to Mickey Mantle being probably the greatest switch hitter of all time. Except the thing that confused me about that specific moment is that Mantle hit 164 righty and 372 lefty, and I don't quite know why that discrepancy in the stats exists, because I couldn't find anywhere that provided the numbers that Mulder gave. It's only off by one. It's not like that big of a deal, but it makes it like all the more perplexing for me.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I did not actually look up those exact numbers. I feel like David Duchovny is a baseball fan. I'm sure that he looked up those exact numbers somewhere. It was 1999. Maybe it was a book. Like, who knows?
Maybe, yeah.
And maybe the book was just wrong.
Oh, no book.
But, I mean, this is exactly the fallibility of proving that you are a baseball fan by just knowing a very specific number. Mostly because I have problems remembering very specific numbers, so I feel like it's only like three baseball players that I can remember how many career home runs they had. You know,
yeah,
it's like Barry Bonds, 762, Hank Aaron, 755, Babe Ruth, 714, and then I'm done.
Bartolo Colon, one.
Okay, all right. Aaron Nola, zero. Cliff Lee, two.
There you go.
All right, so actually I've got six. Great. But yeah, I had some issues in general with the depiction of Mulder's baseball fandom. Mm. There's that sort of opening scene when he has like an ode to box scores.
Oh, yeah. While he's looking at these papers, Scully sort of calls him out on like, oh, you weren't looking at the obituaries, you were looking at baseball from that time, thus setting the stage for Mulder to give this grand speech about the beauty of the box score and how it distills the chaos of baseball into a perfect sequence of numbers that allows you to recreate the game, even years and decades after the fact, in your mind, which is a nice thought, but I think it also isn't, you know, strictly speaking true, but also plays into that myth that we've talked about before about baseball being a constant thing that is the same game that was played 150 years ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and now, which is just like not true at all.
Totally. Yeah. I guess for me also, a box score is a tool. I don't actually love box scores. I know plenty of people who do. But for me, a box score doesn't tell me exactly what happened. Was the pitcher's arsenal working, or did he sort of have to muscle his way through? Did his defense bail him out? Let's say you look at the box score and you see a batter made three outs. Were those on the warning track, or did he pop up to the pitcher? And then did the pitcher make a basket catch like Cliff Lee? Yes, I've made two Cliff Lee references and we're this early in the episode. Yeah, it's weird because I love a player's individual stats, ideally over longer periods of time, and I love any kind of advanced information, but I've never really loved box scores.
You know, the other thing that's weird about that moment is that there is a baseball game on a TV in that very moment.
Yes.
So I can understand being like, oh my God, I'm stuck in this office. I'm looking at these papers. I'm not finding what I'm wanting. Oh, but look at all of this baseball news from this time. That can like quench that thirst a little bit because there's not any baseball on, except not only is there baseball on, it's like on and playing in the room.
Yes. Yes.
And it was Mulder's choice to be in the room looking at the stuff anyway. It's a beautiful Saturday out. Scully didn't want to be there.
Yeah. No, it's very true. And there was a very, very nerdy little nitpicky baseball accuracy note that
Go
I had
on.
With the broadcast, which is, we see that it's a Dodgers game, I would guess, because it definitely sounds like Vin Scully.
Mm-hmm.
And he says Eddie Perez will start it off, but the batter we see stepping in as a lefty, not a righty, as was Perez. And it's a more minor point, but he doesn't even look like a Brave uniform-wise, like an Angel or a Cardinal, maybe?
Yeah, I thought it was Angels at first until the name hit my ears. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, that was definitely not. But that is a little strange.
It's small, but I, you know, we were picking on things like that in Fever Pitch, so.
Also, like, if you're going to be looking for aliens places and we're learning about there being baseball aliens, all of the greats, I mean, the 1999 Braves had, like, at least three possible, very likely alien candidates with Greg Maddux and John Smoltz and Chipper Jones.
Totally.
I mean, alien.
100%. Yep.
And yeah. I think that was Vin Scully. I feel like that is the namesake of Scully in the show. I think that...
Oh, that's so interesting. I never knew that.
I mean, I don't think it's like a big deal. And I might be wrong. And if I am, I'm going to cut this out. But I feel like I read that was not just like a coincidence that the creators of the show kind of did that as a nod to Vin Scully.
Oh, that's very fun. One last thing in that scene. When he says of box scores, it's like the Pythagorean theorem for jocks. Two things. Number one, we actually have a Pythagorean win-loss record. That's the Pythagorean theorem for jocks. And number two, it's not for jocks. It's still for nerds. Even if it's about baseball, it's for nerds. Can attest.
So let's go back to that first game.
Let's, please. I have so much to say about this
because
first game.
Because they're playing at night, which is perfectly fine. This is 1947. And, you know, the Negro Leagues actually pioneered the night games with lights added into them. Since 1930, actually, the Monarchs were using portable lighting systems, which were transported in trucks from game to game so that they could play at night, play more frequently. And I think it didn't happen in the major leagues until like 1935 or something. It was like a number of years after the Monarchs had started doing it. Mm-hmm. And they're playing a team called the Southwest All-Stars. The Grays are playing the Southwest All-Stars. And there is a pitcher named Moose, who's a bespectacled, like, Coke bottle glasses, a little dweeby looking. And he seems to have nor speed nor control over his pitches. So he doesn't really seem that much like an all-star in any way that I could decipher. There's a character named Piney who says that he, quote, couldn't find the plate if you nailed it to his ass, which I thought was a pretty good line. That actor is actually David Duchovny's brother Daniel also.
Oh, that's crazy.
Which I thought was kind of fun. But yeah, he keeps throwing these balls and they all seem to be going wild and landing into this poor, innocent cactus behind.
This obviously foam
cactus. It is obviously foam. And if we can just step very quickly into a subcategory of cactus accuracy, cactacuracy.
Sure.
The saguaro cactus, which is what those are, do not grow in New Mexico. They grow in a very small range, which is largely Arizona and the bit of Mexico sort of like beneath Arizona. There's even like a national park called, I think, the Saguaro National Park that exists in part to protect this species that doesn't exist in a very large area. And so it's not that big of a deal, but it, again, was just a thing that confused me and made me think, wait, where are we? What's going on? It didn't set the scene for me that well because I was like, this is clearly not Roswell, New Mexico. And what are the Homestead Grays doing here? I just didn't know what was what.
Gentle listeners, I am listening with an open mouth stare to this man to whom I am married, if you didn't know, across the table from me, whom I do not know. How do you know so much about cacti?
Oh, she hasn't found my stash of cactus magazines that I keep under the mattress.
Yeah, I never knew you cared so much about cacti.
That I'm a cactus bro?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you never even bought me a cactus until this past year, which our dog killed.
Yeah, she was merciless.
She was very merciless.
No, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about cacti in general, but I did know that. And there you go.
That's very cool. I, too, have some things to say about the cactus, but they're more baseball accuracy than cactus accuracy. Because...
Cactacuracy.
Yes, exactly. Because we see a number of the balls that our bespectacled pitcher, Moose, that Eric has described so well. We see a number of the balls that he has thrown lodging into the obviously foam cactus.
Oh, yeah.
And The shot of the umpire telling the batter that he can take his base. This is essentially the first baseball action that we see. He's turning around to look at the cactus. He is like making eye contact with the cactus when he says, ball four, take your base. So obviously I know he's talking to the batter, but it tickled me. And I felt like, yeah, that cactus should really take its base.
Yeah.
You know, and it's getting a raw deal because it's the one that's been hit by the pitch.
Yeah. Got very good discipline. Little prickly. Huh? Huh?
Yeah.
Yep.
I also considered the following conundrum regards the cactus, which is that as depicted, the cactus is really right behind home plate. Now, obviously the pitch is high, but he keeps nailing the cactus, which really suggests that his control isn't quite as bad as it is meant to be depicted. Like the cactus should really be off to the side for maximum baseball storytelling impact.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that the advice that is given by everyone to Moose is basically just like an arm slot thing. They keep telling him that he needs just to throw over the top, and it's not totally clear what pitches he's throwing. Some of them look like ephuses. Some of them are clearly meant to be fast because they are getting lodged into the cactus, and yet it's all just very confusing, and it is not helped when suddenly he finds his stuff when throwing at various intruders of the KKK variety who arrive on horseback to get Exley.
Yes. There are so many gameplay issues with this first game. So may I, in fact, before we get ahead of ourselves, do a Ellen Adair breakdown about everything that happens in this first scene?
Breakdown! Please, please, break away.
Yes, which, again, there's so much. Feel free to chime in if you'd like. So we've discussed at length the cactus sequence that opens the game. And then at last, Exley comes to the plate and he hits a ball and we see the left fielder go sprinting out for it. But the ball doesn't really seem like it's on a trajectory to go foul. It seems like it's going straight to dead left center.
Mm-hmm.
But then the umpire calls it a foul ball, like way, way after it's disappeared into the night.
Yeah, it's very confusing, especially because they're just kind of playing in a field. There's not like a left field pole that we're
exactly
waiting to see if it's going to like go to one side or another of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is no way, number one, that it's a foul ball. And number two, that that's the point when the ump calls it, because basically he calls it when it's out of his sight, which makes no sense.
Yeah. And just a kind of quick little storytelling thing. It sort of plays at first as though, oh, gosh, look at this racist ump not giving this team a fair shot, because, you know, the Southwestern All-Stars that they're playing are a white team. The umpire is white. And when we see this moment at the plate, I was just sort of thinking, oh, we are getting a, like, this is unfair. Things are hard for this team in 1940s Southwest play, blah, 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 blah. And then it turned out not to be that at all.
Yes. No, I had exactly the same thought the first time that I watched it.
Yeah.
That I was like, oh, I see, the umpire's a bad guy. And then ultimately that is not the case. Because then what happens, we're traveling with the left fielder and he stops in the field and then the ball gets tossed back to him.
Yeah.
So, okay, I get that aliens maybe tossed it back. It's Roswell. But
And it felt kind of like a nod to E.T. Like there's a similar moment in E.T. where like from the darkness, something that gets like thrown back to Elliot.
Oh, that's so
from
funny.
The darkness. But we'll talk about that a little more in storytelling.
But. Yeah, I've only ever seen E.T. in French once, and so I don't know the film particularly well. Instead, it reminded me of the anecdote about when Josh Gibson hit a home run in Pittsburgh, and it was just, you know, a resounding Gibson-esque home run that like disappeared over the wall. And then the next day when they were playing in Philadelphia, a ball just came out of the sky and one of the outfielders caught it and the umpire said, Gibson, you're out, yesterday in Pittsburgh.
That's amazing.
It was probably not intentional, and I'm probably just seeing things through Josh Gibson colored glasses. Anyway, then the next thing that happens in this game is that Exley hits a home run, which mm-hmm. we know because it's called a home run.
Yeah.
Because I guess the umpire gets to call that since there are no fences in the mud field where they're playing. But it would seem to me that when you're playing in a mud field, a home run is the kind where you get to go all the way around the bases before they can get the ball back.
Yeah. Or I feel like playing games as a kid, not on a proper baseball diamond, you can establish those like sort of child rules of like, if it goes past this car, then it's a home run. And if it goes over into like this garden, then it's a foul ball or, you know, like whatever. But there's nothing like that established. We're just like in the desert, basically. And yeah, it's unclear like at what point a ball would be called a home run.
Yes. However, the problems do not end there, because what happens is Exley just stands there. He doesn't even trot. He just stands. He says, "Wow, 61. And his teammates lift him on their shoulders. "Excuse me, nerd police, you still have to touch all of the bases. Otherwise, it doesn't count. Those are the rules."
Yeah, just ask Mr. Merkel about that.
Indeed, yes. Secondly, he's like, "Wow, 61, I broke the record." But if gentle listeners will go back and recall, when did the introduction tell us this is? It's July 2nd. He hit 61 home runs by July 2nd? I don't think you could count anything that he might have done in a winter league, because he would know that that wouldn't mean anything regards breaking Ruth's record, which is what he's trying to do here, which means 61 home runs by July 2nd. Hold up now. I don't want Tom Tango to get upset with me for using on pace, but does this mean he's on pace, the way we normally understand that phrase to mean, to hit more than 110 homers? Like,
heck of a ball player.
Even Josh Gibson did not do that. Josh Gibson was said to have hit 75 homers in 1931, 69 homers in 1934, which is nice.
Nice.
And 84 homers in 1936, but 84 and 120 homers are not the same.
No, no.
Huge baseball inaccuracy. Another sort of illogical number thing, maybe not quite so bad, is how many balls do they have? How many balls does this like semi-pro and Negro League team have? Because
yeah, there's quite a few.
At least 3 to 7 are stuck in the cactus, and then they're just going to let this home run ball go.
Mm.
And then, as you had mentioned earlier, when the KKK shows up, because that is what happens, Moose is able to reliably bean not one, not two, but 3 Klansmen, forcing them off of their horses like Ewok versus Stormtrooper style.
Oh, yeah. Major yub-nub moment.
Yub-nub.
And they're on horseback with like shotguns.
Yeah.
And he's able to hit all 3 moving targets in the head before anyone can even like lift one of their guns. It is an impressive performance from someone who we have not actually seen throw a strike yet.
Yes. So number one, where did he get all of those baseballs immediately? And then number two, is the issue that he's just better at hitting things? And the strike zone is just air? Like, is this why we showed that he actually had pinpoint command with the cactus? Pun fully intended.
Nice.
It just took me that long to finally come back around to your prickly joke. It's still not all that terribly accurate. And there's also, this is sad but true, is a white team really fighting the Klan to protect a black team in 1947? Like, Jackie Robinson has been in the major leagues for 2.5 months and this semi-pro team is going to fight the Klan?
Yeah, that was strange and kind of reminiscent to me of the Jackie Robinson story, how like so many white people in that movie are like, oh, but the racists are those other people.
Yes.
And yeah, that felt a little bit strange to me as well. As you mentioned, Jackie Robinson had just been called up to the Brooklyn Dodgers at the beginning of the 1947 season. The Roswell UFO business, the crash, whatever, was also in 1947. So that all makes sense. Josh Gibson actually died in 1947, although he died in January.
Yeah.
So his career was not exactly an overlap here, although he did play for a while. I think
he was still playing in 1946, like not particularly well, but he was still playing.
Right, right. But I think the 30s were kind of like his heyday, I think.
Yes.
But the catcher of the Southwest All-Stars does also make reference to Robinson with Exley because he says, you know, what with Robinson up, Exley could get called up by the Yankees and be the, quote, first black Negro man of color in the American League. They would have to act very fast, though, those Yankees, as the caption for the evening of this game, as we've said before, is July 2nd, 1947. And the thing about that is Larry Doby would join the Cleveland Indians as the first black player in the American League 3 days later. So Yankees, come on.
They
got to move
real fast.
Do you want Exley?
No amount of seasoning in their minor leagues. Yep.
Nope, nope, nope. But anyway, I thought that was a funny little thing.
Yeah. First of all, that catcher can step right up and get his certificate of redundancy certificate. But on the point of the Yankees scouts that are there to see him, there's the game later on in the episode.
Right.
They pick up and leave in the middle of his at-bat.
Yeah.
I have baseball accuracy problems. What scout is ever going to leave in the middle of the at-bat of the player they came there to scout? Like, I get that the moment is supposed to teach us that he was intentionally missing the ball earlier to put the scouts off his scent, but still, baseball accuracy-wise, no bueno.
Yeah, that was strange.
So let us move along to our next tool, which is storytelling, which encompasses writing, directing, and editing.
Yeah, oh boy. It's so funny because I actually enjoyed this episode quite a bit, but I have yet to give a 50 or higher score, and that is going to continue here. I think I'm really at a 40 again. There's some good stuff that I like about it, but a lot of it is also just kind of confusing. A lot of what I would characterize as sort of like so what moments, like references or nice little ideas that work okay on their own, but don't really seem to be like cohesively like building a story over the course of the episode. The ball getting thrown back being like kind of an ET type reference, that is nice. But it also is like a confusing moment because apparently all of these KKK men on horseback threw the ball back from the dark and were just waiting around for some reason. One of those KKK members being the alien bounty hunter who is an alien who is a bounty hunter, not just a bounty hunter for aliens. Like,
yes.
He's both.
Yes, yes.
And so, like, the moment in and of itself, like, the visual of it is cool. But then when you, like, take a step back to sort of really consider what's actually happening, it doesn't really make sense.
Yes. Is it aliens or is it the KKK? I wasn't ever really sure. And if it's the KKK, like, that was very considerate of them to let them finish the game.
Yeah, yeah. Similarly, Arthur Dales, when he's about to tell this story that takes up the episode, he's got this like little bank that he wants Mulder to put some money into. And he refers to it as Pete Rosebud, which is like a cute little Pete Rose reference.
And it's a nice through line between this and the, you know, a dozen Pete Roses on Valentine's Day from
true.
Fever Pitch.
That's true. That's true. And also clearly a Citizen Kane reference, right? Like Rosebud, we've got the sled burning. Oh my gosh. His childhood innocence and all of what was lost in his youth to pursue the thing that drove him throughout the film. Like, there's no parallel really, though. It's just like a clever, like, oh, this is kind of about the past and memory, and so is that kind of, so we'll throw it in. But like, also, like, so what? Like, it didn't matter that much to me. I felt like it wasn't actually a part of the thing we were watching enough to justify like the cutesy reference, I guess. I didn't hate it, but I didn't quite know what to do with it either, I guess.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I also enjoyed this episode very much, but had a lot of just kind of logical inconsistencies in the storytelling. So I'm grading it 45, which is sort of the grade that I tend to give something when I really enjoyed it the whole time. But actually, a lot of when you pull on the strings, the sweater really just completely falls apart.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Because for me, with race being a character in this episode, I feel like we really have to consider sort of the racial ramifications of the story that it is telling.
Sure.
And so the first time that I was watching this, not really knowing where it was going, and I learned that Exley's disappearance was the same year that Gibson died, I thought, oh, that's sort of an interesting metaphor that he like mysteriously disappeared and we never knew what happened for the unknowability of Negro League stats, you know, like that we don't have the full information about these great players' careers. So, for example, Josh Gibson is said to have hit almost 800 home runs according to his Hall of Fame plaque, but James A. Riley's Biographical Encyclopedia of the Negro Leagues credits him with 962. Whoa. That's a discrepancy. Either way, it mops the floor with Barry Bonds, but what is sad is that we don't know. But I do feel like that was not intended by this episode. That was like a parallel that I was drawing that I don't think the episode was drawing. But instead, the insinuation that Exley wanted to be a black player so that he could fly under the radar and that he is an alien creates some sort of interesting things to unpack, some of which are problematic or some of which are just sort of problematic to me, because it's sort of setting up this parallel between racism and some of the aliens not wanting to intermingle with the human race, like hello alien in a KKK hood, and that conversation that Exley has with Dales on the bus about how, you know, they really just sort of keep to themselves.
Yeah.
And it's like separate but equal or something.
Yeah, it's very like Jim Crow vision of extraterrestrial life.
Totally. And yeah. So I was like, are we implying that black people are aliens? Because that's not okay.
Yeah, that was a little strange. And again, like there is something that you can sort of be like, oh yeah, I guess you could see a little bit of a parallel in what is going on here. But then I think if you really take even just a minute to think about it, it's like, oh wait, no, but this is, what is this even saying? Like,
the question is,
it feels very surface to me.
The question is, in a way, does that save that? Because obviously, proviso, I know I'm a stupid white person and I'm just trying to be less stupid. But I think that the parallels aren't quite clear enough, since we also have the alien in the KKK hood wanting alien racial purity to be making that implication
right
necessarily. And it felt to me like the acceptability of the premise hinges on the fact that Arthur says, as you referenced this moment earlier, that all of the great ball players were aliens, black and white, because then we're not equating blackness with being alien. So he says, for example, Babe Ruth was an alien and Willie Mays was definitely an alien and Koufax, which, like, I love this, but at the same time, it makes the storytelling less coherent.
Yeah, the whole like point of the conflict is sort of undermined by itself, because if this is a big deal, so much so that this shape-shifting alien has to present in a certain way to avoid his alien spot getting blown up, then why were there no problems with Ruth? Why were there no problems with Koufax? And the fact that the show kind of like offers up this problem to its own construct is very strange, not to mention the fact that I don't quite understand how being a good baseball player risks exposure more than infiltrating and joining the KKK and just like straight up murdering people.
Yes, also a problem.
Also the Macon, Georgia Police Department, because Arthur Dales is going to do some background check on Exley in the episode when Exley says that he's from Macon. He calls the Macon Police Department, and the person who ends up talking to him is the alien bounty hunter. So it's like, was this guy just...
was he waiting there?
Waiting for this specific guy? It was just all very confusing. I'm getting a little bit scattered here.
But like, so is the story a little bit.
But just to sort of go back to the point that I think you were bringing up, which is just that it is weird that it is presented as a problem for Exley to become well-known enough to join the majors when the show then immediately suggests that, like,
very
the best
well-known
and
people
most famous major league were players
aliens.
Were also aliens.
Yes, like, which is it?
Yeah.
You can't sort of have both.
And it really tries to have both.
Yeah. And I mean, this is the point where I have my own somewhat personal objection, and it mostly has to do with the parallels to Josh Gibson again, which, as I've said, are so clear. So explaining away the fact that Gibson or a player like Gibson didn't play in the majors because he didn't want to, when the reality was that it must have been heartbreaking for him. It makes me sad. And I think what it comes down to with me on baseball accuracy, that they make him so clearly like Josh Gibson, knowing that Gibson was suffering with a brain tumor from 1943 and still slugging despite being in incredible pain and having actually one of his best seasons, and knowing then that Robinson was chosen in 1945 and he wasn't and still playing and getting a batting title. It's hard to turn that story into, oh, I don't really want to play in the majors because I'm an alien. Like, I feel like it robs something from that story.
I think you're right. I think it absolutely does.
But I also feel like there are so many sort of inconsistencies in the story presented in the form of Arthur Dale's narration. And I sort of had a question about, like, is this episode intentionally constructing Arthur Dale's as an unreliable narrator? So,
oh man, I don't know.
He says, like, I also have a sister named Arthur Dales and a goldfish. And it's sort of like, maybe his name isn't Arthur at all. Maybe he's making all of this up. It's sort of like, if you look at the Odyssey, there's a certain point when it could be said that Odysseus is, like, making everything up to a certain point.
Sure.
It sort of felt like, is that what we're supposed to be getting out of this?
I don't know that I actually can answer that question totally to your satisfaction, but I do have some information that may be useful here. So the character of Arthur Dales, the agent, had already appeared in a couple of episodes of The X-Files. The character was originally to appear in The Unnatural, the agent Arthur Dales and not his brother. However, the actor unfortunately had to step down from the episode because of illness.
Mm.
But they had already done some of the filming of the stuff in the past with, like, young Arthur Dales. So
being
they still
called Arthur Dales, mm-hmm. presumably. Got it.
So they had to, like, come up with a solution of, like, well, what do we do when the guy who's played this role in the past, who's been established, how do we fix this mess? And the way that they did it was this kind of, like, I don't know, kind of funny way of, like, oh, the Dales family was just particularly unimaginative when it came to naming things. So they have two sons, a daughter, and a goldfish all named Arthur. So that is, like, practically why that happened. But intended or no, it does make some questions arise in terms of, like, what's going on and, like, how do we trust what we're hearing, particularly because the role is played by M. Emmett Walsh, who's a wonderful, amazing character actor, but, like, part of his thing sometimes, and in this case, is, like, a little, like, you know, could be crazy person.
Yeah.
He's got, like, his bedraggled hair and they're, like, drinking and, like, so it doesn't strike me as odd to question his reliability.
I have a lot of thoughts. So, number one is that it is so interesting to me that with the X-Files sort of being in some way the heir of the Twilight Zone, that there is another issue with having to do reshoots, just like in our episode of the Twilight Zone.
Oh, yeah.
Bum, bum, bum. This is, yes, very similar, like, strangely thematic. But I still feel like, even if that's the case, they made the choice for him to say, yes, I'm Arthur Dales. My brother is also Arthur Dales and my sister and our family goldfish, because you could very easily have said, oh, that's actually my cousin Arthur. We're both named after my grandfather. You know what I mean? There's a way to do it without it quite being like, do I believe anything that you say?
Or you could just have a different character be like, oh yes, Uncle Arthur told me about this, but he's away. Or you could find like a journal, or like there are other ways to...
Well, yeah. And it seems to me like it almost has to be a choice to make the episode work because of the way that the story ends, which is this very fairy tale...
Oh, yeah.
Type resolution. Talking about specifically the Josh Axley story, because what happens is he is killed by the alien, bounty hunter alien.
Mm-hmm.
And he is cradled in the arms of young Arthur Dales, and he says, no, no, our blood is like acid to you. So,
and we had seen that earlier in the episode when Exley gets hit by a pitch and some green, acidy alien blood kind of like comes out from where he got hit and sort of like gets all over a catcher's mitt.
Yes. But then in that moment when he has said, no, this is my true face, like his human face and not his alien face, suddenly he is bleeding human blood and not alien blood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of, the story is that the power of love of baseball can change your blood.
The note I took was, did we just have a Pinocchio?
Yeah, it's definitely like Pinocchio.
Also, like, his love of baseball was constant and remained the same. I can't imagine how getting stabbed by a bounty hunter is going to, like, affect your love of baseball. I guess you're literally sacrificing yourself for it or whatever. But yeah, that was another one of those, like, kind of so what moments of, oh, what a nice thought to put something like this into the episode. I wish it had been worked in better.
Yes, yes. Because I feel like the idea of sacrifice as a kind of a magic charm is in fairy tales for a very long time.
Sure, sure.
But the rest of this episode that we've seen is mostly just science fiction, and then all of a sudden it's a fairy tale. So for example, The Mighty Casey, the Twilight Zone episode that we did, has very much elements of a fairy tale, but it sort of feels like a fairy tale all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this just felt strange, and like perhaps that was part of the fact that we were hearing this story through the character of Arthur Dales ? Kind of allowed for a little bit of, maybe that's not literally what happened.
Yeah, but I feel like, I kind of feel like maybe we are supposed to, because it doesn't seem like Mulder is overly skeptical of it either.
I'm going to disagree with you on both of those points. I think he's pretty skeptical. And I also feel like from very, very early on in the episode, the whole idea of metaphor and not literalism is a theme.
Sure.
So Mulder and Scully are sort of trading metaphors in that early scene.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of points which were slightly annoying to me when he's trying to put together the story that Arthur is telling him, and they're like surrounded by the refuse of both pizza boxes and Chinese food. So apparently they got and ordered both. And Arthur is just sort of saying, well, you just really want to tie everything together, don't you? And you just really want to make it make sense.
Mm-hmm.
In a kind of like, you know, it's a metaphor, don't take it literally sort of a way. And I feel like those kinds of things were added into this episode. We've talked about this before, in a kind of like, if you feel like your script has a weakness, then just point it out at a certain point and it doesn't become a weakness anymore.
Uh-huh.
Which sometimes works very well. And here I just felt like I saw the fact that you're trying to say, don't take it literally, folks, as a way to make your story not make any sense.
Right.
But actually your story just doesn't make any sense.
One other thing that, again, is just like, okay, I get it, but I don't quite know what to do with it, is the tagline of the episode. So normally after the title sequence, all of that, it will land upon the truth is out there. And there are a few episodes where that is replaced by something else. And that is the case with this particular episode. And in this episode, we get the words "in the big inning" as the tagline, which, you know, is obviously a reference to the book of Genesis, i.e., in the beginning, God created the heavens and all the other stuff too. Good job, God.
That's
Thank
exactly
you very much.
That's exactly what it says.
Yeah. Well, hey, it's the King Ralph version of the Bible.
Yes.
You know, again, like, I get that it's a pun, and I get that you're making a biblical thing a baseball thing, but I don't really know what to do with it otherwise.
Yeah, and also, we never really see a big inning, you know?
No, we don't.
We just see foul ball and a home run, and then a hit by pitch, and then another home run. We never see base runners running around. We never see a crooked number go up on the board.
Yeah. So we mentioned this a little bit before. Exley gets hit by a pitch, and when he does, in one of the games, sort of in the middle of the episode, he bleeds a little bit, this green, acidy blood, and then also starts speaking in tongues, just like how I did expertly at the beginning of this episode.
It was spot on.
That said, at the very beginning of the episode, when we're seeing the KKK get assaulted by Moose and his newfound baseball control, the alien bounty hunter gets hit and he turns back into an alien. And so that was just a basic thing of like, well, what is it? Like, shouldn't the bounty hunter have also started speaking in tongues, or shouldn't Exley have turned back into an alien? It's just like we saw two different results from the same action, and that just confused me.
Yes. Yep. So the first time that we watched this, I just thought, why wasn't the alien making sure to have his human face on under the hood? I guess he just thought he could get away with wearing a KKK hood. But then it becomes very clear that no, he's only sort of not making his human face because he's been knocked out. But then when Exley gets knocked out later, he does not lose his human face. So yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Why does one bonk make one thing happen and another bonk makes another thing happen?
I don't know.
Consistency among the head bonks.
Please.
Also, this could be a thing that, like, I don't know if this is clear if we had watched more episodes of The X-Files or what, but the bounty hunter mentions that Exley's playing and possibly exposing himself by playing baseball, whereas, again, murdering people is fine, I guess, and not calling attention, quote, risking the entire project by playing. But it's very unclear what that is, and again, like, why joining a KKK, like, lynch mob type situation isn't going to risk it. And again, that like sort of separate but equal, we stay to ourselves, they stay to themselves. Like, I wanted at first to be like, is this out of necessity because there was a UFO crash and they're just kind of like stranded here? Or are they here on purpose, which is what like the risking the entire project thing seems to suggest? And basically, this is all to say, like, isn't every alien on Earth inherently intermingling with other people?
Yes.
Question mark?
Yes. Yes.
Because I don't quite see any alternative to that.
Yeah.
And again, it just didn't really make sense.
In terms of the whole project thing, that's a case where I just thought, oh, I don't know what that is because I haven't seen other episodes of The X-Files, and so I'm not counting that against this. But it is true. Every alien taking up residence on Earth is automatically intermingling with humans. That is what they are doing.
Yeah. I'd love to talk really quickly about the weird child who is maybe an alien.
Oh my God, yes.
So there's a little kid who comes to give Arthur Dales a bottle of booze. He has Mulder tip him. And when he gets the kind of crappy Mulder tip, is like, oh, regular Rockefeller, ain't you? Or something like that. That is just like obviously
old-timey,
not contemporary speech. And he also is dressed like a newsboy.
Yeah, definitely like, not even like 1947. Yeah, he looks like straight up an extra from Newsies.
He looks like a Newsies extra. It's totally true. And we then see him leave, and it cuts to this transition of him like going to a ball game. In 1947, he's like following X. It's all well and good. And I feel like that suggests that maybe he is an alien. Like when Dales tries to follow up on Exley and calls Georgia, they tell him that there was like a child named Josh Exley. We also see Exley turn into like a beautiful woman at one point. So like the shapeshifting can be to all different types and ages of people, maybe a child in the past. And so I just kind of assume that what that was saying was that the kid was actually also an alien. But like, I don't quite know why that is.
I think you made more sense of it almost than I did, because I just sort of thought, what's up with all of the time blending question mark? Because there's not just that, there's also the instant when in 1999, on Arthur Dale's very old-timey television, he is somehow watching the alien bounty hunter alien.
Yeah, it was a transition that, like, again, it like looked kind of neat, but it didn't make a lick of sense.
It doesn't make any sense. Yes, it's also advertising bus lines from some time ago. So the thing that is particularly puzzling, that's kind of like, okay, what are you trying to say, that time is a flat circle? Is that also one of the metaphors of this?
All right.
Is that also one of the metaphors of this episode? That's one thing. But then to have Agent Mulder not appreciate the fact that this child, not only that he sees the one time in Dale's hallway, but also that he subsequently hires at the end of the episode to feed balls into a machine for his batting practice with Scully, that he does not notice that this child is dressed like an extra from Newsies, it does make you wonder how good he is at his job.
Yeah.
To not observe something like that.
Hey, Mulder, sometimes the truth is right in front of you.
Sometimes the truth is right there.
Forget out there. What about right here?
Exactly. So I guess I didn't assume that the boy was an alien, because then isn't that sad if he doesn't know that there's an alien right in front of him?
I don't know.
But it regardless, that he's never like, hey, nice costume, kid. Like, he just doesn't absorb it at all. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, those little hats and suspenders are totally what the kids are wearing at the turn of the 21st century.
Yeah, to me, I got very strong alien vibes and was trying to think, like, does this alien know about Arthur Dale's friendship with Exley and just sort of like has a connection through that? But like, what is that if that's the case? Shouldn't the alien be better at blending in than it apparently is, if it is in fact an alien that is in the form of a kid? And again, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and I think that it's something that we're not really meant to think too much about, but yes. I couldn't help it.
Yes, friends, that is sort of the subtitle of Take Me Into the Ball Game. We shouldn't think too much about things, but we kind of can't help it.
It's true. The quick version of that also was, I was like, Arthur Dales is following Josh Exley around. That's sort of how they become friends over the course of this episode, as a kind of protection, because he sees like a wanted dead or alive type poster,
yeah,
like for a bounty on Exley. And is like, well, actually, you can either be in jail and be safe there, or I can follow you around. And I was like, I feel like there might be a jurisdictional issue for them to be just going off on the road with like a random cop from a small town.
Yeah, I honestly, the first time we watched it, I didn't even understand why he was traveling around with them. I thought that he was there because they were there playing somebody in particular, and he was there to protect him for a single game. And then I realized, oh no, it's somebody in the hometown of the Roswell Grays that wants to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, no, ultimately that wasn't a storytelling problem that I had, but I did think about it. So at long last, friends, let's move along to our next tool, which is score.
Score tool!
And I think I'm going to go 55 here.
Oh, yes. I also am a 55.
We discussed on our Twilight Zone episode that TV scores sometimes are just kind of rehashing the themes that they already have, but it is clear that that is not what is going on here. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of nice sort of slide guitar music, which definitely says Negro Leagues baseball. if anything does.
Oh,
and I think it did a good job of enhancing the mood.
Yeah, I agree. Mark Snow did the score. He's done a lot of TV, tons and tons of X-Files, but also Blue Bloods, Ghost Whisperer, Smallville, done some movies too. I think he recently did the score for the New Mutants movie. He has 15 Emmy nominations. It's all very good. And it is a nice balance, I think, of the heartfelt and the silly kind of whimsical aspects of the episode. And I think does a pretty good job of helping to sell this story, sort of strange as it can be sometimes. The other thing to mention that's maybe a slightly different from score is there is that lovely song, the like hymn that they sing of the We'll All Be Together in That Land, which is a good use of Jesse L. Martin when you have him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very lovely. It's because he sings it on the bus and then it plays again in that final scene.
Yeah.
That's very lovely.
I got a brother in that land. I got a brother in that land where I'm bound, where I'm bound.
What do you think about the acting in this episode? Moving along to our next tool.
I'm a 60 for the acting. I think that it's quite good. I think that Jesse L. Martin's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think M. Emmett Walsh is also really, really wonderful. And I like David Duchovny. I mean, I think Gillian Anderson's also great, but she's barely in this episode. Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of specific things to say with regard to the acting, but I just thought everybody did like a pretty high quality job. And I would include the bounty hunter and young Arthur Dales in that too.
Yeah, I'm also a 60. I could see somebody going 70. I think that everybody is uniformly great in this down to the last co-star, but I just don't know that there's anything that's really specifically impressive enough to warrant a 70. I sort of feel like the closest to a 70 that we get is maybe Jesse L. Martin. He's so, so excellent.
Yeah, he's great.
Just intensely charming. Although I did feel like his death, not the whole death scene, but the moment of his actual death, I feel like he could have gotten more out of it. He just sort of chuckles and then closes his eyes. But maybe that's what he was asked to do. Yes, and David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson are excellent, although we don't get very much of Anderson in this episode, as you said. Although watching her, I was definitely like, I need to do less. I also really liked Frederick Lane, who plays Arthur Dales the younger, and I feel like the scenes between Martin and Lane are wonderful. I feel like they're really inhabiting with each other.
Yeah.
And I very much liked the way that they played off of each other.
I agree.
So our next tool is delightfulness of catcher character. And there are a couple of different ways I feel like I could go with this. The only catching that we see happening is in that initial game where the catcher razzes Exley about how he has instructed his poorly controlled, bespectacled pitcher Moose to chuck it at, quote, his nappy head.
I believe it was big, nappy, home run hitting head.
Yes. So that's not so delightful.
Nah.
Yeah. You sort of get the sense that he's razzing Exley as part of his catcher job because he also helpfully provides exposition about how many home runs he's hit and that the Yankees are scouting him and stuff like that. But as far as catcher delightfulness goes, it's pretty low.
Yeah.
He slightly redeems himself when the KKK rides in and he takes up one of their guns when it's dropped. But I'm just sort of like, oh, that's where he is on the racism spectrum.
Right.
The catcher that we see when Exley is hit by the pitch is very concerned and gives him his glove as a pillow. And then, apparently, gives his glove to Dales to do unknown experiments on. And so, even though he has no lines, that's very nice. So I feel like 55 for him and maybe like 40 for our opening catcher. On the other hand, what position does Exley play?
I don't know.
We never learn. I mean, is he supposed to be like Josh Gibson? And if so, is he a catcher? If so, he is not as delightful as Leon Carter, but he's pretty delightful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the fact that we don't really get to know whether or not he is a catcher, and the fact that he is the superstar, but he's not necessarily the team leader, puts somewhat of a cap on his delightfulness. But I'm still going to give an aggregate score like we did for the Stratton story and say 55 if Exley is also a catcher.
Okay. I'm a 45 mostly for those reasons, although that doesn't really take into account Exley. So I don't need to talk a whole lot about this. The only other thing that I would say is that the catcher at the beginning maybe could have done a better job of protecting that cactus from some of those pitches. We don't actually see him catching a whole lot. There's a lot of wild pitches thrown his way, but I was like, I wonder if he could have stopped a couple of those.
JT Realmuto could do better.
JT could have done better. The only other thing is, and I forgot to mention this in storytelling, is it is very strange when that glove with the alien blood on it just goes to this kind of like small department scientist who seems like mostly not super shocked. He's like, this is inexplicable, and I don't know how any living thing could even do this, but he's got a kind of like, isn't that something kind of attitude about it, as opposed to just being like completely shocked to his core by a thing that should not be?
Well, he's a scientist, so maybe he's like some part of him is sort of excited by the possibility instead of just freaking out.
Yeah, yeah.
Intellectually curious.
Fair, fair. It does not get any better, though, when the alien bounty hunter in the form of Exley comes in to murder the scientist, which doesn't make a lot of sense because it's unclear why he would know to go to the forensics lab, why he would also know what Exley looks like if he has been hunting for him. But I'm just exhausted to even think about it, and we don't need to talk about that
There's
anymore.
There's a lot of storytelling issues, friends. I don't know if you got that from what we were talking about before. So let's move along to our next segment, which is Delightfulness of Announcer.
I'm a 30 here. I will try to stick again. I'm not going to do it forever, but I'm going to try to stick again to normal gym-friendly scores. There's a part of me that would maybe go like slightly higher, but I'm going to go with 30. We get almost no announcing, but in the present day, we do get some Vin Scully, which is great. We get like a, what a beautiful day for all of the people in the country from this place over to that place. And what a great day to not do what Mulder and Scully are doing right now is basically the thrust of the announcing.
Not an alien in sight. Yes.
The skies are blue and the people are not green or gray because we are all humans here at this baseball game.
Totally. Yeah, it's tough because we only get a couple of seconds of Vin Scully. And I just don't think that I can send this in saying, well, the only announcer is Vin Scully and he's an 80, so 80. Like, Jim wouldn't really have an accurate read on how much delight you get from an announcer in this. So I'm also going to go 30.
Fair.
So our next tool is lack of misogyny. And, you know, for 1999, as a standalone episode, it's not exceptional. There's really only one woman with any lines, and that's Scully. And she's A, barely in any scenes, and B, actively deplores baseball. In the last scene, she says, I've found more necessary things to do with my time than slap a piece of horsehide with a stick.
Oof.
He also makes fun of her for liking an ice cream substitute, which feels sort of like these chicks and their health food.
And it's not presented as ice cream substitute. It's presented as non-fat tofutti rice creamsicle. Like, what a silly choice that a silly girl would make.
Yes, exactly. Because she wants to be like skinny or something. On the other hand, if you were fat, that also wouldn't be okay. I guess it's true that she ends up liking hitting a ball at the end of the episode, but she does say, quote, I'm playing baseball, and she's not. She's having batting practice. But of course, she is Scully, and she's otherwise smart and wonderful. And I get this feeling that Duchovny was trying to write something in that final scene that was a little ode to his co-star. So 40, I guess.
I'm at a 40. Yeah. I mean, they've got their nice banter, you know, and they do have their like nice exchanges. And, you know, she is definitely wanting to be outside on that day, even if it's not to play baseball. And she's got that line, do you ever entertain the idea of trying to find life on this planet? And Mulder says, I've seen life on this planet, Scully, and that's why I'm looking elsewhere. Ooh, sick burn, planet Earth life. But in those exchanges, I don't like, I think that she looks well. She looks smart. They've got the trading barbs or like sayings that you mentioned before of, Let sleeping dogs lie. Preparation is the father of inspiration. Necessity is the mother of invention. The road to excess leads to the palace of wisdom. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. Like, they seem very well matched intellectually, which I do very much enjoy. I appreciate that she wants to go outside and have fun on a nice Saturday. But yeah, there's not a whole lot there. And I think that the stuff with like the ice cream substitute and all of that, like, definitely put it a little under average.
Yeah. To be clear, I think that the moment that Exley turns into a woman is actually sort of misogynist neutral. Yes, she's an object, but she's just a shape that he's taking. And I think that the point that he's trying to make is about men and not about women.
Hmm.
Although, I do kind of want to know what's going on with that woman in the trunk. When we see the alien bounty hunter alien looking in the trunk and there's the body of a woman there, and then he closes the trunk and we never know what that was about.
I didn't even notice that it was a woman.
It was definitely a woman.
Too busy trying to be like, wait, that car has a New York license plate, but you're coming from Georgia to New Mexico. Like, how did that happen? Stop at like the Enterprise rent-a-car and just get a it's not worth talking about. That's maybe a little too nitpicky, but it was something that I noticed and was like, that's the Statue of Liberty on that license plate.
Yeah. Yes. So now we're going to move along to our next segment, which is a bonus segment just for this episode.
What?
And I am calling it Alien or Not.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
So let's say that what Arthur Dale says is true. And some major leaguers are aliens. We're going to put aside for the moment the sort of questionable storytelling thread in this particular episode. We're just talking about that one premise. So which of these current players are aliens? You can analyze if you want, but we can also make this quick and you can just go with your gut. Okay?
So, okay.
First player, Mike Trout.
100% an alien.
Mike Trout is absolutely an alien. Like,
oh, yeah.
You don't even have to introduce me to this concept for me to tell you that Mike Trout is an alien. It's actually the only logical explanation for Mike Trout.
You could have asked me that before we watched this episode, and I'd be like, yeah.
Yeah, you're definitely an alien. What about Mookie Betts?
Ooh, probably.
I feel like he's a very adorable alien, but he is an alien nonetheless, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
What are your feelings about Jacob deGrom?
I mean, I think, yeah, I think so.
Definitely, definitely an alien. Ronald Acuna?
Unclear. I think real alien potential. I got my eye on him. I'm going to be sending Mulder and Scully to watch some games to really give him a good looking over.
Yeah, I think Ronald Acuna is clearly an alien.
Okay.
Yeah. What about Max Scherzer?
Are these just all yeses?
I mean, I wasn't going to put like Scott Kingery on this list. I'm not putting people who are obviously not aliens.
I mean, I kind of want to say yes again.
I disagree. I don't think so.
Okay.
I sort of think that there's something inherently like human about Max Scherzer's like grunting and like just ferocity. And one of the things that I love so much about Max Scherzer, besides his slider, is the way that he's just sort of an excited beast. And it feels sort of quintessentially human to me. So I think Max Scherzer is just a very excellent human.
Okay, that's fair.
What about Aaron Judge?
Nah, I'm going to go with a no there.
Yeah, same for me. I feel like when he first broke on the scene, I would have been like, this guy is definitely an alien.
Oh yeah, he was on the watch list for
sure. Look at him. But now I'm like, I don't think an alien gets injured that often. What about Garrett Cole?
I think yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, have you seen Garrett Cole now that he's shaved? He's obviously an alien. Juan Soto.
I'm going to go no. I don't know that an alien would grab his crotch as much as Juan Soto does.
I think that's fair. I think it's sort of like the Max Scherzer argument. On the other hand, his plate discipline at such a young age. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about Juan Soto. I think he might be an alien.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. Christian Yelich.
Nah.
Yes. Here's the issue.
He's just a person who looks like an alien.
That's exactly the problem that I was about to say, which is that I feel like Of all major league players, he perhaps looks the most like a sort of a prototypical alien. Mm-hmm. And so if that's the case, it's not a very good disguise.
Yeah.
Also, this season, I think, maybe proved that he's not an alien. What do you think about Francisco Lindor?
I'm going to go no again.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that there's something about Lindor that just feels quintessentially human. Do you think Matt Chapman is an alien?
No.
I think he might be. That defense. To me, I feel like the line between alien and not alien might be Matt Chapman and Matt Olson.
Okay.
What about Trevor Bauer?
I feel like he might be an alien.
Okay. I don't think that he's an alien because I don't think that an alien would have his own vlog. I feel like an alien would definitely think that that would be a little bit too risky.
I guess he would really have the bounty hunters on his tail, too.
Yeah.
Like,
he seems
like... He draws a lot of attention to
himself. Exactly. He seems so obviously like an alien that I think, not in the Mike Trout way, in the other way, that I feel like he's maybe not an alien. What about Aaron Nola?
No.
Aaron Nola is not an alien, and that's what I love about him so much. He's great, but he's very human. So, that concludes our bonus segment, Alien or Not. And now, for our next segment, a classic one, yes or no. Would this episode be better with Kevin Costner in it?
I think I'm going to go with a yes. I feel like he would be a very good young Arthur Dales. I think that you get some moments of him like playing ball, playing catch with Exley, chatting with the team. I think that the kind of like passion of Costner and the sort of like wistfulness of him would lend itself well to this type of story. And I just imagine kind of the vibe that you get in Field of Dreams when he's like throwing batting practice to Shoeless Joe, that kind of like, aw shucks, I'm in the presence of greatness energy, I feel like would be present and helpful here. So I'm going to go yes.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that the episode certainly wouldn't be worse with Costner in it. But I think, again, we have the question of whether or not Costner really makes sense in a non-baseball role in a baseball-related script. Mm-hmm. And I quite like Frederick Lane. So I'm going to go no. I don't think that it would necessarily be better with Kevin Costner.
Okay.
Does this episode reference Babe Ruth?
It sure does.
In more ways than five.
Yeah.
Or maybe not five. I just threw a number out there.
I mean, so Josh Exley is referred to as the Black Babe Ruth. Which is, of course, as you mentioned before, how Josh Gibson was referred to as being, although this did also spark a response that Babe Ruth was actually the white Josh Gibson, though Gibson's career came later, as we've discussed before. Also in the episode, Exley hits his 61st home run, and there's talk about breaking the record, which is, of course, referencing Babe Ruth's 1927 season, which was really good, but boy, one of many, many good ones. If you were to go by his .545 weighted on base average for 1927, it was only his sixth best season, his high point being .598 in 1920. Isn't that crazy?
Ugh, I love weighted on base average.
Yeah. But so yes, Babe Ruth aplenty.
Yes. And I mean, there's also that scene that we mentioned when Mulder is naming various players.
Oh, who may be aliens.
Who may be aliens,
right.
Just as I did. And Babe Ruth is the first one that he mentions.
Right.
Joe DiMaggio, Willie Mays, Mantle, Koufax, and Gibson, Bob or Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a dog?
There be no dogs there's in this no land.
Dog.
No.
There's no dog.
Would have liked one.
Are Yankees fans the main antagonist of this episode?
Not strictly speaking, no, but the Yankees themselves are treated as like a sort of ideal, like the top of the mountain. And because of the attention drawn to them, they, as well as their fans, by extension, are the enemy of these shape-shifting aliens who are on Earth for some reason and seem to be drawn to baseball despite an almost fundamental alien aversion taboo to the participation in the sport. Also, the Yankees scouts presumably are Yankees fans, as they want them to do well, so on and so forth, but their presence is a major threat that risks blowing up Exley's alien spot. And so them being there is a bad thing for our protagonist, which makes them antagonists.
Yes, this is exactly what I had. The main antagonist is clearly the alien bounty hunter alien. But it's important to note that the Yankee scouts are side antagonists because Exley doesn't want to be discovered by them.
Yeah.
And also, for anyone who doesn't like this episode, I still feel like I like this episode, but for anybody who doesn't, the answer is yes, because David Duchovny is a Yankees fan.
Ooh.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Bought it around. Yep, it's true. Well, on a lighter note, what about 6 degrees of baseball?
So for this, Emmett Walsh, our replacement Arthur Dales, also appears as Chuck Ireland in the 2007 film Chasing 3000, which I had never even heard of up until I was poking around looking to see who else had done what. I think it's a family film related to Roberto Clemente's 3000th hit.
Oh, that's so fun. That's the nice thing about 6 degrees of baseball. We keep adding things to our stable of films,
yeah,
which is totally 100% an intentional Kevin Cash reference. Did you have a favorite moment of this episode?
Nothing like super duper stands out, but I guess I'll go with the early Mulder Scully scene where they're kind of like doing the exchanges and the banter. And I just thought that that was a really nice little scene where we saw some good stuff and there was some fun writing there. So I'm just going to go with that, I think.
My favorite moment is sort of related, but it's specifically when Mulder says, "The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom." What, William Blake? Marriage of heaven and hell in the house. Woo!
All right.
What about your least favorite moment?
I think for the least favorite, for me, it is when Dales first discovers Exley. He sees Exley as an alien, just like taking some swings in his hotel room.
Because that's definitely what baseball players are doing
for
in their hotel room.
Yep. Reason.
Just taking some hacks.
It's all very, yeah. So when he discovers him, he sort of passes out. And then there's this like sequence where he comes to and then passes out again several times in quick succession. And tonally, it felt a little bit strange to me. And I also just, I didn't feel like that moment was sold very well. And I didn't really like it.
Yeah, tonally, it was inconsistent. And another sort of problem with that scene is that it was an extended scene with the alien mouth, which moves a little bit, but
yeah,
not enough to make you believe that you could have the same vocal production as a human.
Or diction.
Yeah. Yes, or diction. Like, it just, producing sound just doesn't work that way. It would almost have been better if there had been no mouth whatsoever.
Yeah.
And it just would have like magically emanated from the resonance of his skull or something. However, my least favorite moment was the moment when Arthur Dales is first on the bus with the Roswell Grays and he makes some joke about how they should all wear policemen's uniforms instead and then they could be called the Roswell Black and Blues. And all of the teammates sort of crowd around him. And there's this moment when it's unclear if he's going to be like menaced by this team of black men for making a joke. And it was not my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
What about a scene that you would like to see?
Maybe a scene that just kind of lays out the stakes or the background of the aliens a little bit more. Like, why exactly being a baseball player exposes you more than murdering people and joining the KKK?
Yes.
Like, I've mentioned this before, but I do think that since it really is the main conflict of this episode, like so much of this episode revolves around this issue, that just having a little bit more background on it could help me understand what I'm seeing a little bit better. Because I just was constantly like, but why? Like, why is this bad, but the other thing isn't? And yeah, it's not the most interesting answer, but that's honestly how I feel about it.
I don't feel like I have the most interesting answer either, but it's because neither could I think of something that was like really silly that I would like to see, nor could I think of something thing that like one scene that was gonna somehow solve some of the discrepancies in the script. So I guess the scene I would like to see is Axley catching, and they're playing the Indianapolis Clowns, and we see a woman come up to bat.
Ooh.
And I know that the timelines wouldn't match, but we've already got the Homestead versus Roswell Gray's problem. So, you know, at this point, in for a penny, in for a pound.
Yeah.
What was your favorite performance?
Oh. Do you think that we're just going to let you not mention your dreamiest player?
I legitimately forgot about it. I mean, it's obviously Josh Exley.
Yeah, it's not even close.
There is that other player on his team who is quite handsome, who has a few lines, but I don't know what position he plays or how good of a baseball player he is. So it's still Josh.
Okay, that's fair. In terms of my favorite performance, it does seem like Jesse L. Martin is probably the easiest and maybe even best choice here. But I really do like Emmett Walsh. I think he's an amazing actor, and he has done so many good things over like decades. Everything from like The Jerk and Raising Arizona and Blood Simple to like Harry and the Hendersons. Like there are a lot of movies that I just adore that he is in. And I know that that is like baggage that I should not necessarily bring into like a particular performance, but it does make it hard for me to be objective about this. And so like, I think I'm going to actually go with him as a slightly unexpected answer.
Well, I guess I'm just expected and basic because I'm going with Jesse L. Martin.
Hey, he's a good choice.
Oh, he's just so good. The way he listens, but also the way that he's watching his scene partners when he's listening.
Mm.
Yeah, it's so good. He's exceptionally effortless and natural and charming, but he's so specific at the same time. And he has some great laughs in this episode, which laughing, like real laughing, is hard to do. People don't realize how hard it is to have real laughs.
Oh, Ellen.
They're more impressed by tears, but I feel like tears are easier than real laughs, honestly. You're just proving my point. So thank you so much for joining us for our discussion of this X-Files episode. If you would like to watch what we're going to be talking about next in advance of our next episode, we will be watching the 2019 film called 12, which we don't know very much about, but when we first started this podcast, it was actually recommended to us on Twitter, and so we're going to check it out.
All I know is that it's one more than 11, but it's not as many as 13.
Indeed, yes. Excellent, incisive commentary.
I'm a numbers guy.
You really are. It's what I've always said about you. So if you would like to find us on the internets between now and then, my Twitter handle is @Ellen_Adair, and my Instagram is @EllenAdairG.
And I am @EricGildy on both of those things.
I always love how surprised you are. And...
Ha-ha! Is that one better?
No, I meant it genuinely. And if you enjoy this podcast, it would be lovely if you could give us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple or wherever applicable, you know, maybe on HelloFresh, you can give us a 5-star rating and a review.
Ooh, yeah.
And we would like to thank AudioFan781 for doing that very thing. And they write, 3 strikes. Then... As a baseball, movie, and podcast fan, this hits all 3.
Oh, nice.
So we are the pitchers in this scenario.
Yeah,
this
throwing some heat.
This is like a Cliff Lee 3-pitch strikeout.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. And I got my 3rd Cliff Lee reference in at the same time. Ah, talk about 3 strikes. So thank you so much for listening with us, and we will talk to you next time on Take Me Into the Ballgame.
Bye, guys.